In 1962, Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest burst onto the literary scene, forever changing how we view mental institutions and the nature of conformity. The novel, which Stephen King called one of the finest novels of the 20th century, emerged from Kesey's experiences working as an orderly in a psychiatric hospital while participating in CIA-funded psychedelic experiments. The book became a counterculture Bible, challenging authority and celebrating individual freedom during the turbulent 1960s. Its impact was amplified by Milos Forman's 1975 film adaptation starring Jack Nicholson, which swept all five major Academy Awards. What makes this story so enduring is its exploration of power dynamics through the eyes of Chief Brumden, a supposedly deaf-mute Native American who witnesses the battle between the tyrannical Nurse Ratched and the rebellious Randall McMurphy, a struggle that resonates with anyone who has ever felt crushed by institutional control. The psychiatric ward operates as an exquisitely calibrated machine under Nurse Ratched's meticulous control. She manipulates every environmental factor, from the volume of the perpetual muzak playing through hidden speakers to the deliberately altered speed of the clock, creating an atmosphere where patients remain docile and compliant. Her starched uniform, perfectly arranged cap, and rigid posture embody the mechanical precision she demands from her domain. The ward's inhabitants are clinically divided into acutes, potentially curable patients, and chronics, permanent cases deemed beyond help, with each man systematically reduced to a mere component in her vast institutional machinery. Chief Brumden, our narrator who strategically feigns deaf-muteness, perceives beyond the hospital's antiseptic facade to what he calls the Combine, a vast mechanized conspiracy designed to process humans into conformity. Through his eyes, we see the ward's true nature, a processing plant where individual will is gradually ground down through routine, medication, and psychological manipulation. The fluorescent lights buzz constantly, the floors gleam with an unnatural shine, and even the air seems sanitized of human warmth. Nurse Ratched's most insidious tool is the group therapy session, which she masterfully transforms into what McMurphy accurately labels a pecking party. During these carefully orchestrated meetings, patients are subtly manipulated into attacking each other's deepest vulnerabilities while the staff clinically documents each emotional wound. The circular arrangement of chairs, the precise timing, and Ratched's practiced tone of therapeutic concern mask the session's true purpose, maintaining control through mutual degradation. When patient Pete Boncini briefly rebels against this system, crying out that he was born dead and has endured so many insults in his 55 years, the response is swift and mechanical. He's efficiently sedated, becoming like an old clock that won't tell time but won't stop neither. A perfect metaphor for the ward itself, where time passes without purpose or meaning, marked only by the monotonous rhythm of daily routines. The ward's black attendants serve as Ratched's mechanical extensions, enforcing her will through calculated small humiliations and ever-present threats of the shock shop, where electroconvulsive therapy awaits troublemakers. Their rubber-soled shoes move silently across the polished floors as they observe, report, and maintain order. In this carefully constructed environment, patients have surrendered their humanity, becoming what Harding describes as rabbits, too afraid to challenge the wolf that rules them. The ward exists in a perpetual fog, both literal in Chief Bromden's vivid hallucinations and metaphorical in the patient's chemically dulled consciousness, where men hide from reality rather than face it, their spirits slowly corroding in Ratched's perfectly maintained machine. Into this sterile, controlled environment storms Randall Patrick McMurphy, a boisterous, red-headed gambler transferred from a prison work farm, wearing work boots and a motorcycle cap tilted at a rebellious angle. From his first laugh, a free and loud sound that hasn't been heard on the ward for years, McMurphy represents everything the institution seeks to suppress: vitality, sexuality, defiance, and natural human impulses. His very presence disrupts the ward's carefully maintained atmosphere of quiet submission, like a gust of wild air through a sealed room. Unlike the other patients who've internalized their supposed illnesses, McMurphy proudly announces he's faking insanity to escape prison labor, declaring himself too smart to waste time crushing rocks when he could be playing cards in an air-conditioned hospital. McMurphy immediately recognizes Nurse Ratchet as his natural enemy, telling Harding bluntly, "That nurse ain't some kind of monster chicken, buddy. What she is a ball cutter." His street-smart instincts cut through the facade of therapeutic care to see the truth, that her power comes from emasculating the men psychologically, making them doubt their manhood and self-worth. When he learns that most patients are there voluntarily, he's baffled by their willingness to remain under her control, comparing them to chickens in a coop who've forgotten how to fly. McMurphy's rebellion begins with small acts, organizing card games for cigarettes, mocking the black attendant's servility, questioning arbitrary rules about medication times and shower schedules, but escalates when he bets the other patients he can get the best of that woman within a week. His gambling nature transforms every confrontation into a game of high stakes, where dignity and autonomy are the ultimate prizes. His first major confrontation comes over watching the World Series on television, a seemingly trivial matter that represents the larger struggle for autonomy. When Ratchet refuses to change the word schedule, McMurphy organizes a democratic vote, demonstrating the power of collective action. However, Ratchet cunningly manipulates the rules by counting non-participating chronics against him, revealing how institutional power maintains control through bureaucratic maneuvering. In a pivotal moment that becomes ward legend, McMurphy attempts to lift a massive control panel in the tub room, betting he can throw it through the window and escape. The other patients watch in awe as he strains against the impossible weight, veins bulging, face reddening with effort. Though he fails, his willingness to try, "But I tried, though. God damn it, I sure as hell did that much now, didn't I?" becomes a powerful symbol of resistance. The chief, watching this display of raw effort, begins to reconnect with his own suppressed strength and humanity, remembering his father's teachings about standing up against oppression. McMurphy's gambling spirit becomes contagious, showing the men that even losing while fighting for freedom is better than winning through submission. His actions demonstrate that true strength lies not in success, but in the willingness to risk everything for one's beliefs. Chief Bromden's narrative perspective provides the novel's most profound insights. Having retreated into feigned deaf-muteness after years of being ignored and belittled, he observes the ward through a haze of paranoid hallucinations. He believes the hospital contains a vast machine room where staff perform horrible crimes at night, and that Nurse Ratchet can control time and fill the ward with fog to keep patients disoriented. The chief's awakening begins gradually as McMurphy's presence disrupts the ward's routine. One night, McMurphy catches him hiding chewing gum, and instead of reporting him, offers him more. This simple act of kindness prompts the chief to speak for the first time in years. His voice emerges rusty from disuse, and when he tries to laugh, it sounds like crying. This moment marks the beginning of his reconnection with his authentic self. Through late-night conversations, the chief shares his story with McMurphy, how his once powerful father, Chief T. Amilatuna, the pine that stands tallest on the mountain, was broken by white society and the government that wanted their tribal lands. He recalls how, even as a child, white officials would ignore his perfect English, treating him as if he were invisible. These experiences taught him that people's machinery disposes of words like they weren't even spoken when they don't fit what they expect to hear. McMurphy offers the chief a deal. If he promises to become big again, to reclaim his physical and spiritual strength, McMurphy will include him on a fishing trip and help restore him to his former size. This bargain becomes the catalyst for the chief's transformation. As the fog in his mind begins to clear, he realizes that his diminished sense of self was not inevitable, but a choice he made in response to oppression. The chief's journey from invisibility to agency parallels the novel's larger theme about reclaiming personal power in the face of dehumanizing systems. The fishing trip represents a crucial turning point in the novel, a temporary escape from institutional control that allows the patients to reconnect with their authentic selves. When transportation issues threaten to cancel the excursion, McMurphy manipulates Dr. Spivey into joining them by having Candy, a young prostitute friend, flirt with the doctor. This small con exemplifies McMurphy's talent for exploiting others' desires while simultaneously offering them what they need. Initially, the patients feel uncomfortable outside the hospital, acutely aware of their green uniforms marking them as loonies. At a gas station, they face hostility until McMurphy transforms the situation by leaning into their stigmatized identity, proudly declaring them dangerous criminals and himself a murderer. This performance shifts the power dynamic, turning their perceived weakness into strength. Harding realizes with sudden clarity that mental illness could have the aspect of power, that being labeled crazy could be liberating rather than limiting. Out on the ocean, the men experience a kind of rebirth. George Sorensen, a germophobic patient, reveals himself as an experienced boat captain. Billy Bibbit finds confidence through Candy's attention. The chief feels the fog in his mind clearing with each mile they travel from shore. When they hit a school of fish, chaos erupts, lines tangling, fish thrashing, men shouting, culminating in a moment of pure, unbridled joy. McMurphy's laughter during this scene becomes the novel's emotional center. He laughs at the girl, at us, at the captain back at the pier, at everything, because he knows you have to laugh at the things that hurt you just to keep yourself in balance, to keep from going crazy. This laughter spreads to everyone on the boat, creating concentric circles that crashed on beaches all over the coast, wave after wave after wave. For perhaps the first time, these damaged men experience genuine community and unfiltered emotion. The return journey through rough seas tests their newfound courage, with George expertly navigating dangerous waters. When they dock, the same locals who had mocked them earlier now treat them with respect, sensing their transformation. The fishing trip demonstrates that freedom, even temporary, can restore dignity and humanity that institutional life strips away. After the fishing trip, Nurse Ratch launches her counterattack, exposing McMurphy's profit motives to undermine his credibility. She methodically presents evidence that he's been exploiting the patients financially, suggesting his apparent generosity is merely calculated self-interest. This strategy successfully plants seeds of doubt among the men, who begin questioning whether McMurphy genuinely cares about them or is simply running another con. The turning point comes during a mandatory cleansing in the shower room. When the black attendants harass George about his cleanliness phobia, McMurphy intervenes despite having recently decided to stop fighting the system. The ensuing brawl lands McMurphy and the chief in the disturbed ward, where they face electroconvulsive therapy as punishment. McMurphy refuses to submit, telling Nurse Ratch he regretted that he had but one life to give for his country and that she could kiss his rosy red ass before he'd surrender. Each shock treatment visibly diminishes McMurphy. Though he maintains his rebellious facade, the chief notices his increasing exhaustion. His face drained of color, showing the fear I'd seen reflected in the windshield on our coast trip. McMurphy's deterioration reveals the true cost of resistance. Each act of defiance brings him closer to destruction, yet he continues for the sake of the other patients who now depend on his example. The final confrontation occurs after Billy Bibbit's suicide. When Candy visits the ward for a date with Billy, they spend the night together in the doctor's office. The next morning, Nurse Ratch discovers them and methodically destroys Billy's newfound confidence by threatening to tell his mother. Billy's stutter returns violently as he panics, and when left alone, he slashes his throat with surgical instruments. Nurse Ratch coldly blames McMurphy. First Charles Cheswick, and now William Bibbit. I hope you're finally satisfied. Playing with human lives, gambling with human lives, as if you thought yourself to be a god. This accusation triggers McMurphy's final fateful act, attacking the nurse and attempting to strangle her. The chief understands that McMurphy acts not from personal rage, but from collective necessity. We couldn't stop him because we were the ones making him do it. Following his violent confrontation with Nurse Ratched, McMurphy faces the institution's ultimate weapon of control, the lobotomy. This surgical procedure, once celebrated as a miracle cure in psychiatric medicine, represents the Combine's most extreme method of enforcing compliance. When McMurphy returns to the ward weeks later, his physical form remains intact, but his essence is destroyed. His face appears too blank, like a store dummy, and his eyes resemble smudged fuses in a fuse box. Metaphors that emphasize how the procedure has reduced him from a vibrant rebel to an empty shell. The institution has achieved its surface-level victory, transforming their most defiant patient into a breathing monument to the consequences of resistance. However, McMurphy's apparent defeat catalyzes an unexpected revolution within the ward. His sacrifice creates ripples of change that the Combine cannot contain. In the weeks following his lobotomy, patients begin asserting their autonomy in unprecedented numbers. Some sign release papers they'd feared for years, while others demand transfers to different facilities. Harding, who once used his intellectual sophistication as armor against genuine emotional engagement, discovers the courage to face the outside world. The ward's population steadily decreases as men find the strength to reclaim their lives. Even Nurse Ratched's authority suffers an irreversible blow. Her damaged throat, a physical wound from McMurphy's attack, forces her to communicate through written notes, effectively silencing the voice that once commanded absolute control. This transformation from verbal to written authority symbolizes a fundamental shift in power dynamics, as her previous ability to manipulate through tone and inflection is permanently compromised. The chief's final actions serve as both mercy and tribute to McMurphy's legacy. Recognizing that his friend would rather die than exist as a cautionary example, the chief smothers McMurphy with a pillow, an act that preserves the memory of his rebellious spirit rather than allowing his empty body to serve as the institution's trophy. The chief then accomplishes what McMurphy couldn't, lifting the massive control panel from the floor and hurling it through the window. This act of liberation demonstrates how McMurphy's influence transcends his physical defeat, as his strength lives on through those he inspired. The novel concludes with the chief's journey toward both his past and his future. Hitchhiking toward Canada, he plans to visit the Columbia River, seeking any remaining members of his tribe who haven't succumbed to government manipulation and alcoholism. Those who haven't drunk themselves goofy since the government tried to buy their right to be Indians. This final journey weaves together themes of cultural identity, resistance, and renewal. The chief carries forward McMurphy's spirit of rebellion while seeking to reconnect with his own heritage, suggesting that true liberation requires both breaking free from oppressive systems and reclaiming one's authentic identity. Beyond its literal narrative, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest functions as a powerful allegory for broader social control. The psychiatric ward represents any institution that values order and conformity over individual freedom, schools, corporations, governments, or cultural norms that suppress authentic human expression. Nurse Ratched embodies the faceless authority that maintains these systems, not through obvious tyranny, but through subtle manipulation, shame, and the illusion of therapeutic concern. Her methods, from group therapy sessions designed to humiliate to the strategic use of medication, mirror society's sophisticated tools of conformity. The novel's genius lies in showing how control systems rely on victims' participation in their own suppression. Most patients are voluntarily committed, choosing the familiar pain of institutional life over the terrifying freedom outside. They enforce rules among themselves, having internalized the very standards used to judge them as deficient. The morning meetings, where patients are encouraged to confess and criticize each other's failings, demonstrate how social control operates through self-policing and peer pressure. When McMurphy asks why they don't simply leave, they have no answer, except fear of failure, of responsibility, of facing a world that has already rejected them. This paralysis reflects broader societal patterns where people remain in unfulfilling jobs, toxic relationships, or oppressive situations out of similar fears. The chief's hallucinations about the combine reflects Kesey's critique of mid-century American conformity and mechanization. Through the chief's eyes, we see how modern society processes unique individuals into standardized products, identical men in mirrored suits emerging from trains like half-life things, cookie-cutter housing developments spreading across the landscape, and schoolyards where children learn painful lessons about fitting in. His visions of hidden machinery and control panels behind the ward's walls symbolize the invisible systems of power that shape human behavior. The chief's paranoia contains a crucial kernel of truth. Systems of control do operate invisibly, making people complicit in their own oppression through subtle mechanisms like social media algorithms, consumer culture, and standardized education. Yet the novel ultimately affirms that resistance is possible, even necessary, despite its tremendous costs. McMurphy's rebellion fails in conventional terms. He loses his mind and his life, but succeeds in awakening others to their own capacity for freedom. His sacrifice demonstrates that authentic individuality often comes at a price in conformist societies. The chief's dramatic escape, smashing through the window and fleeing into the night, suggests that while the machinery of control remains powerful, individual liberation remains possible for those willing to risk everything for it. This message resonates particularly strongly in our contemporary era of surveillance capitalism and digital conformity, where the mechanisms of control have become even more sophisticated and pervasive. At its heart, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest celebrates the indomitable human spirit that persists even in the most dehumanizing circumstances. McMurphy's most revolutionary act isn't his physical resistance, but his laughter, a natural, uncontrollable expression that the ward's machinery cannot process or suppress. His booming, infectious laugh echoes through the sterile corridors like a force of nature, disrupting the artificial quiet and challenging the very foundation of institutional control. This laughter represents everything genuine and spontaneous about humanity that no system can fully eliminate, serving as both weapon and shield against the ward's oppressive atmosphere. The novel suggests that true sanity isn't measured by conformity to social norms, but by authenticity and connection. The supposedly insane patients often demonstrate more humanity than the staff who treat them. McMurphy, diagnosed as a psychopath, shows more compassion and understanding than the supposedly rational authorities. Whether he's teaching Billy Bibbit to embrace his sexuality, helping George overcome his germophobia, or encouraging the chief to reclaim his voice. The chief, lost in paranoid hallucinations about the combine, perceives deeper truths that others miss, seeing through the facade of therapeutic care to recognize the machinery of social control beneath. Even Colonel Matterson's seemingly nonsensical statements, "America is the plum, the peach, the watermelon," contain poetic wisdom about abundance, freedom, and possibility when viewed from the right perspective. The fishing trip scene encapsulates this theme perfectly. Away from the hospital's controlled environment, surrounded by nature's chaos, the patients rediscover parts of themselves that institutional life had suppressed. Their transformation is remarkable. Harding's intellectual defenses fall away as he learns to bait a hook. Billy's stutter diminishes as he masters the fishing rod. And Scanlan's aggressive tendencies channel into the productive work of cleaning fish. Their laughter on the boat represents a moment of perfect freedom, genuine emotion shared in community, expanding outward to touch everything around them. The sea spray, the rocking boat, and the wild uncertainty of nature provide a stark contrast to the ward's artificial order. Kesey's masterpiece endures because it speaks to universal human experiences. The struggle between individuality and conformity, the search for authentic connection in an increasingly mechanized world, and the courage required to remain fully human in the face of systems designed to reduce us to manageable parts. Through McMurphy's rebellion, from organizing card games to challenging Nurse Ratchet's authority, and the Chief's gradual awakening from his self-imposed silence, we're reminded that even when the machinery of control seems all-powerful, the human capacity for laughter, love, and liberation remains our most potent weapon against it. The novel's lasting message is that our humanity, with all its messy, unpredictable, and beautiful expressions, cannot be fully contained or controlled by any system, no matter how efficient or well-designed.